This Week in Nuclear, episode number 31, October 21st, 2006. Welcome to the show. This is John Wheeler, and you're listening to episode number 31 of This Week in Nuclear. This podcast focuses on news, facts, and commentary on the commercial nuclear industry in the USA and around the world. In our first story this week, Toshiba's $5.4 billion US dollar purchase of Westinghouse Nuclear is virtually complete. Toshiba is buying 77% of Westinghouse Nuclear from British Nuclear Fuel. The remaining 23% will be owned by Shaw Group, who will hold 20% of the new company, and Ishigawa Jima Harima Heavy Industries Company of Japan, who will own 3%. This deal comes on the heels of more than $8 billion U.S. dollars of investment in Toshiba's semiconductor business over the last 3 years. The European Commission cleared the deal on September 19th, and U.S. Federal Trade Commission followed 10 days later on September 29th. This time we took a look at the new company that's positioned to provide a large percentage of the world's nuclear plants in the coming decade. Toshiba is a diversified manufacturing conglomerate that produces everything from semiconductors, computers, televisions, and home appliances, and now nuclear power plants. Their computer chip business accounts for more than one-half of their operating profit. Toshiba's nuclear power business currently generates about $1.7 billion in annual revenue, and they expect it to grow to about $7.6 billion by the year 2020. With that increase in earning, Toshiba expects to recoup their investment in 17 years. Just this week, they announced they'll consider issuing $3.4 billion in bonds to fund the purchase. That's a bit risky in the eyes of some analysts because it'll raise their debt-to-equity ratio to more than twice that of their competitors. That's risky unless you believe the demand for nuclear plants and services will ride faster than the financial bean counters predict. If it does, then their purchase could turn out to be the deal of the century. Toshiba posted better-than-expected earnings this week for the most recent quarter, and their timing couldn't be better because it will help ease investors' concerns that they may be overextending themselves with the huge deal to buy Westinghouse. This week, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission levied a $60,000 fine against the owner of the D.C. Cook nuclear plant in Michigan because they failed to obtain the NRC's approval before making a change to their emergency plan back in 2003. I'm not bringing this up because I disagree with the fine. I don't know enough about the technical merits of the specific situation to weigh in on that. The utility is not contesting the fine. I do, however, want to discuss how it's being handled by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and why this kind of fine doesn't work. The NRC may choose to issue fines as a punitive measure or punishment when a nuclear plant violates a regulation. But you have to ask, who's being punished? Well, the fine's paid by the utility, so the shareholders are the ones who are bearing the burden. But you might think that the shareholders would hold the management team accountable, and in many cases they do. The problem here lies in the length of time that's passed between the infraction and the penalty. The mistake was made more than 3 years ago and was corrected shortly after it was discovered, so the condition has not existed for about 3 years. As is often the case in these situations, many of the managers and executives who were in charge at the D.C. Cook plant 3 years ago are no longer in their positions. So there's no one for the shareholders to hold accountable. Worse than that, the current staff has had to deal with the fine and with the negative press they'll get as a result. Believe me, the negative public relations generated by the fine is far, far worse than having to shell out $60,000. By comparison, this week the British regulating body announced they've issued a fine of 500,000 British sterling pounds to British Nuclear Group for a leak that occurred in April of 2005 at the Thorpe Fuel Reprocessing Facility. British Nuclear Group has a contract to operate the facility, and the facility owner, the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority, also withheld £2 million in payments to British Nuclear Group last year after the leak was discovered. While the leak was sizable, the fluid was contained within the barriers installed at the site, and none escaped to the environment. I have to question the size of the penalty in this case in essence, 2.5 million pounds for an event in which there was no actual or even potential safety risk and no release to the environment. But at least the penalty was levied much more promptly. In the case of D.C. Cook, the public good is not being served when there's a delay in issuing the fine, because the public is led to believe that there are problems at the plant now, when in reality, they haven't existed for more than 3 years. To make a simple analogy, the NRC is crying wolf, and the utility, rightfully so, says, hey, there's no wolf here, it's been gone for 3 years. In the end, the public doesn't know who to believe, and both parties lose credibility. And this contributes to an environment where the public doesn't feel they can trust either the utility or the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. That gives third parties, the anti-nuclear groups, an open door to run in and save the day. They come to the rescue claiming the utility is covering things up and the NRC is going easy on the industry. How many times have we heard that? I've lost count. Well, what's the fix? I honestly believe the NRC should eliminate the use of civil penalties for all but the most severe cases. And then the penalties should be stiff and swiftly levied out. Since we're discussing emergency plans, I wanted to bring your attention to an event that speaks to the incredible good brought by the Sharon Harris Nuclear Plant in North Carolina. About 2 weeks ago in Apex, North Carolina, there was a huge fire at a chemical storage facility in the middle of the night that caused a release of deadly chlorine gas. More than 16,000 people had to be evacuated from their beds, and it was done quickly and safely. From everything that I've read about the event, the evacuation was done without panic and without incident. What I didn't hear was any mention of the fact that the emergency planning infrastructure in Apex and the surrounding communities was developed primarily by Progress Energy, the owners of Sharon Harris Nuclear Plant, as part of their emergency plan. The citizens of Apex have Progress Energy to thank for the well-organized response that kept them informed and alerted of the need to evacuate. I've seen this repeated all over the USA. Communities that have nuclear plants have a well-organized and well-funded emergency response organization that's had the benefit of training that they get from the nuclear plant staff. They put that training to use in all kinds of emergencies. The newspapers and the mainstream media rarely pick up on this, but if you talk to the state and county officials, and I have, they'll tell you that they're much better prepared for all sorts of emergencies because of the funding, equipment, and training that they get through the nuclear plant's emergency preparedness program. British Energy is in tough shape because of unplanned outage at the Hinkley B nuclear plant. The company is unable to produce enough power to meet their obligations, and they'll have to purchase power on the open market. This means higher cost generators that burn natural gas will be coming online to fill the gap, and British Energy will have to absorb the added cost. This realization by investors caused British Energy shares to tumble. The company has lost 25% of its market value in a few days. This situation underscores the vital importance of high reliability and being a predictable generator of electricity. Nuclear plants make a lot of money when they're running, but unplanned outages can make that profit disappear in a hurry. That's true of any baseload power plant, but when the low-cost provider shuts down, the problem is amplified because the owner has to make up a greater difference between the contract price for their low-cost power and the market price, which in this case is driven by natural gas. The units are down because of boiler tube cracking that was discovered first at a similar plant at the Hunterston site in September. British Energy made the safe and conservative decision to shut down Hinkley to inspect for similar cracks. And when they did, they found them. The Hinkley B nuclear plant consists of two 660-megawatt advanced gas-cooled reactors that came online in 1976 and in 1978. They provide about 3% of the United Kingdom's electricity, and right now they're supposed to be in service until 2011. Of course, this outage has the local anti-nuclear groups dancing in the streets. Jim Duffy of Stop Hinkley was quoted as saying, "This is the beginning of the end for the nuclear plant," and he added that the government needs to start building wind turbines so they, quote, have enough power to cook their breakfast in the morning. Well, he's off base on more than one account. There's plenty of high-priced power available that can be brought into the area, but he'll be stuck on a diet of beans on toast when his energy bills triple or quadruple. And I'm chuckling at his comment that the government should come to the rescue. He obviously doesn't have a clue of what deregulation and privatization of the electrical grid means. The government isn't coming to the rescue. Market forces will dictate where his replacement power comes from, and it won't be wind. Jim Duffy also predicted that the plant would be down for 3 or 4 months. Now, I don't know the details of these boiler tube cracks or what it takes to fix them, but 4 months is an eternity when it comes to nuclear plant outages. Boiler tube cracks that I've repaired in the past have only taken a few days to correct. Heck, plants can replace entire steam generators in less than 3.5 or 4 months. My guess is that they'll do the inspections in a couple of weeks, and they'll plug any defective boiler tubes, and we'll be back online in under a month. They may have to run at reduced power if they plug more than a certain number of tubes, but they'll be back online nonetheless. I'm going to mark this date, and I'll report back to you in 30 days to see if my predictions are true. On Thursday, Areva and Mitsubishi Heavy Industries announced they've signed an agreement to jointly develop and design a new 1,000 megawatt Generation 3 reactor. Both companies stated they expect strong demand for their mid-sized unit in Southeast Asia and in Eastern Europe. They also said they expect demand for their 1,000 megawatt design in the USA, and they might be right. I kind of doubt it, though. The economies of scale have proven to be a dominant factor in nuclear power plant economics in the USA, and larger units, while more costly to build, have an advantage when it comes to overall operating costs because the size of the plant staff is not proportionally larger, and the added cost of fuel is a minuscule fraction of the total operating cost. This is certainly true of baseload units connected to a well-established electrical grid. I do believe in the viability and value of small power reactors, particularly in remote areas where the distances to other forms of generation make transmission costly, and there's insufficient local demand to support a large power reactor. Small power reactors also have the potential to be used in other applications like ship propulsion, hydrogen production, and water desalination. If you want to learn more about this topic, you should visit Adams Atomic Engines and their website at www.atomicengines.com. And by the way, I happened to listen to a good discussion of small reactors on the Atomic Show recently, so tune into that podcast as well. Anyway, Mitsubishi and Areva need go no further than Maryland for some great ideas on small power reactors. Anyway, I'm getting off track. Both Mitsubishi and Areva specialize in pressurized water reactors. Areva is the international arm of Framatome, and they've built all 53 of France's units. And Mitsubishi has built 23 of Japan's 55 reactors. In researching this story, I discovered something I hadn't realized. Areva is the only company in the world that provides the entire nuclear fuel cycle, starting from the mining of the uranium to enrichment, fuel fabrication, plant design, construction, operating the plants, used fuel reprocessing, and plant decommissioning. This seems like a good deal for both companies, and it follows a pattern that's been shaping up recently with Japanese companies partnering with or acquiring nuclear construction companies. Toshiba and Westinghouse, General Electric and Hitachi, and now Areva and Mitsubishi. It'll be interesting to see how this relation manifests and what kind of creativity it'll bring to the nuclear plant drawing board. Here's an overview of Russia's plan for expanding their domestic nuclear power industry. Russia has 31 operating nuclear power plants that provide 16% of their electricity. In addition, a few of their plants provide steam for heating the cities where the plants are located. Russia has an interesting situation in their energy supply. At present, most of their electricity, about 80% of it, is generated from natural gas-fired plants. Russia has large natural gas reserves, and they export a lot of it to the rest of Europe and Asia. The figures I have for 2004 indicate they export about 157 million cubic meters of gas per year, which is a little bit more than one-third of the gas that they produce. They use 60% of their natural gas to produce electricity. As it turns out, that's an extremely expensive proposition. Gazprom, the Russian gas company, earns five times more for the gas that they export compared to the gas that they sell at home. So they have a huge financial incentive to replace gas-fired plants with nuclear plants. Not only do nuclear plants produce electricity more cheaply than gas plants, but it frees up gas for export, which is a huge source of revenue. There are some other factors driving the nuclear renaissance in Russia, but this gives you an idea of the financial one. Earlier this year, they announced their plan to reduce their use of natural gas and to double their nuclear power output by 2020. That'll bring nuclear energy to about 23% of the projected energy generation at that time. And this week I got some details on how they plan to finance their nuclear renaissance. Russia has formally adopted a $54 billion U.S. dollar nuclear energy development program. Between now and 2015, the Russian government will contribute $25 billion to the program. After 2015, 100% of the program funds will be covered by Rosatom, the Russian nuclear power company. Russia has three nuclear plants under construction, and they'll add seven more in the near term. This will result in 10 new reactors totaling at least 9.8 gigawatts online by 2015. They'll be building two new reactors per year from 2011 through 2014, and then they'll ramp up production, and they'll have three coming online per year from 2014 through the year 2020. That's a pretty aggressive nuclear construction program, and don't forget, they'll also be building new plants outside of Russia. I'm putting some links in the show notes to the information I use in this story. Russia is not hampered by the politics of Western nations. They see an opportunity and they're going to grab it. I, for one, think it's smart. It's like an agile company that takes advantage of changing market conditions to gain market share. Russia is making a play for the world's nuclear plant market. If you were a country looking to buy a nuclear plant, are you going to buy one from someone who hasn't built one in years, or maybe has only built two or three? Or are you going to buy from someone who has a robust construction program who can demonstrate their capability? One thing Russia has going against them is the reliability of their plants has not been nearly as high as light water reactors built in the USA, France, or other countries with Western technology. The GE, Westinghouse, and Framatome reactor designs have demonstrated long-term capacity factors much higher than the Russian-built plants. 5 or 10 percentage points may not sound like a lot, but there's a huge difference in the cost of electricity generated by a plant that runs at 75% capacity compared to one that's running at 90%. That alone more than offsets the price difference between a Russian-built plant and one built by GE, Westinghouse, or Framatome. Russia has been making some headway in recent years to improve their capacity factors, but they're still not anywhere near those of Western plants. I really admire Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel for sticking to her guns and speaking out even when her position is in violent disagreement with that of her political party. She's been keeping an open mind about options to secure Germany's energy supply, and just today she made her strongest remarks yet in support of advancing nuclear energy in Germany. In a speech given at a party rally, Chancellor Merkel said it was a mistake for Germany to stick with their plan to phase out nuclear energy over the next 14 years. In addition, she criticized the Social Democrats for refusing to reconsider laws previously passed that will shut down the nation's nuclear plants by 2020. Her exact words were, quote, "I consider it wrong that we're turning off our nuclear plants only because that is what was already agreed to." Later she added, "No one can prevent us from discussing the topic of energy anymore. We're facing challenges and need to develop strategies to ensure our energy supplies over the years ahead." Germany's 18 nuclear plants supply 32% of their electricity, and all 18 plants are mandated to shut down by a law that was passed by the Green Party and the Social Democrats when they were in power. I wonder where the Greens and the Social Democrats think Germany is going to get their energy from. Hey, I know. How about getting it from the Russians? You'd think the people of Germany would see the writing on the wall. If they phase out nuclear energy now, they'll be wholly reliant on Russia and their natural gas for their electricity. This really amazes me. Eastern Germany spent the better part of the last century under the thumbs of the Russians and the Soviet Union. If they shut down all their nuclear plants, that produce 32% of their energy, they're going to be completely reliant on the Russians once again. You'd think the people of Germany would see that, and they would understand what that means for their political future. Well, that's all the news for this week. I want to remind you that you can stop by my website at thisweekinnuclear.com, where you can find links to some of the stories I talked about today. And there's also links to many other sources of nuclear industry news. There's also a button you can click on if you'd like to contribute to the show via PayPal. If you're at the American Nuclear Society winter meeting in Albuquerque, New Mexico in November, be sure to look me up. I've mentioned before that I'll be joined there by Rod Adams of The Atomic Show and Eric McElhane of the NEI Nuclear Notes blog. The three of us will be holding a panel discussion on the new media that includes some tips on podcasting, and we'll be sharing our experiences, spreading the truth and the science behind nuclear energy using this fantastic new media. Well, it looks like episode number 31 is a wrap. Thanks for listening to This Week in Nuclear. This is John Wheeler. Have a great week.